Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Wednesday night edition of Sports Conversation. I'm Don Henderson. We've got a great show for you, I think, tonight. A lot of baseball, a lot of football, a lot of what's happening in the world of sports all around the country. And as normal, we'll go with Roy Cummings down in Tampa, Florida first. We'll try to contain this first segment to a lot of football because Steve Cassella is going to join us the second half hour, and we'll be doing a lot of baseball in the second segment. So, Roy, first of all, welcome to the show. Roger Henderson is in Atlanta, ready to go. And I think you had one of the surprise games of the weekend. You were talking about what Tampa was going to do, what the Buccaneers were going to do, and they took on what most people thought was going to be a Super Bowl contender in the Lions, and they put on quite a show.
Yeah, they did. And, look, I still think the Lions will be a Super Bowl contender, but Tampa proved that, you know, like last year, a year ago, I mean, they went in there, had some played a good game, kind of got worn down at the end, and just couldn't finish it off, and you know move Detroit out of the playoffs and move on. So Not surprised that it went the way it did. I mean, I figured it was going to be a close game. I think both teams have improved a bit. And, you know, I still think the Lions overall are probably the better team. But you know what? Tampa figured out a way to beat them the other day, and they did it. You know, this is impressive. They did it without a couple of key players. They had no Luke Getteke, their starting right tackle, which really showed up. That's why Hutchinson had such a great day. And they didn't have Vita Vea for a good part of that game either, which is one of their more critical players on the defensive side of the ball. So I would say that, you know, Tampa, yeah, a bit of a surprise. But those of us who've been watching the team know that this team's got a lot of skill and ability and that they could easily win 10, 12 games this year.
Roger, maybe an equal surprise on Monday night. Everybody expected the Philadelphia Eagles to march up and down the field and win a game handily. Looked in the first half as they were going to do exactly that. And then the bottom fell out.
And did it fall out. And then, you know, after Jason Kelce on the pregame show, I think he predicted 60-0. And every one of them predicting the Eagles, but they foul up, and they did not deserve to win that game for several reasons. But they should have been able to stop the two-minute offense, and they should have scored more points. And of course, if Saquon Barkley hadn't had that one pass go off his fingertips. But as Frank was saying before the show, at least we know Hurts is back as a runner getting over 80 yards.
Well, I think, too, you know, we can point to what everybody did not only during the course of the game, but at the end of the game and then into the postgame show with Ron Jaworski and company on the postgame show following. You know, we can look to that pass. It was dropped. The passes are dropped. The Giants had exactly the same thing happen to them. Their star receiver dropped the ball on the sideline, which would have given them an opportunity to win their first game and not go down 2-0. And, Roy, that's football. I mean, you have all your chances to win. You can't pin it just on one play.
No, you can't, but let's face it, that was as critical a play. The game is over at that point. If Saquon Barkley catches that pass and he's caught, you know, he'll catch it 99 times out of 100, and or maybe the next 100 times out of 100 that you throw into him. this time he dropped it, and as Roger pointed out, the defense couldn't quite hold against a darn good quarterback, you know, arguably one of the best quarterbacks in the league last year until he got hurt. And a guy who, you know, there's a reason that everybody thinks Atlanta can win the division. And that guy behind the center is the reason. And he went and showed, you know, what you do. And look, one thing I've never understood about the NFL is just how soft defenses become in a 2-minute drill. You know, obviously offenses are becoming, you know, super aggressive in those moments, but defenses become ridiculously soft, and it really hurt the Eagles there. I thought they certainly needed to, you know, present more of a pass rush. They only rushed three or four, and they had no. I mean, it was basically two on one in every instance there. They were giving up obviously the middle of the field and just way too much open space there, and it ended up costing them. I think the Eagles learned a couple of lessons there. I don't think it does them in. I still think that in that division where the Cowboys certainly aren't anything to be too feared of at this point, I still think the Eagles are going to be just fine. But that was a tough one to lose because you had it in your pocket and you let it get away.
And Roy, they play New Orleans this week. And New Orleans at NFC South, it's tough.
I was going to say, before we get over to the Dallas game, let's finish with the Eagles, because your point is well taken. As they said on the postgame show again, following Monday night's game, you can't go, you know, 70 yards without any pressure at all on the quarterback. And they really had no pressure at all. You could talk about being soft. It was not soft. It was liquid. I mean, they weren't anywhere. They weren't any. They weren't anywhere near the receivers, and you let them go right down the field and win the game, and you just can't do that. They just reemphasized and reemphasized that somewhere somebody's got to step up defensively and make a play, and the Eagles didn't do it.
And kudos to Roger for bringing that up, because, Don, you really just nailed it on the head. Most everybody is going to look back and say, okay, Saquon Barkley drops the pass and that's the game. But the defense has to make a stop. You have to make a stop there. You have to say, okay, look, our guy messed it up. We didn't get the points we were expecting to there. Now it's up to us to make sure that they don't score. And
we got a 6-point lead.
Liquid.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the other thing. You know you've got to force a touchdown. They've got to score a touchdown, and you just gave up the touchdown so easily. Again, that was a big, big mistake. I mean, a lot of mistakes, and just in that entire series, it was like the Eagles never quite figured out what they want, how they really wanted to approach that situation. They certainly didn't seem prepared for it, and maybe it goes back to coaching and preparation during the week that. Maybe they just didn't have a good game plan put together for that moment, because it certainly looked that way on the field.
And, Roger, let's go down to Dallas, because look what happened down there. I mean, you talk about a little bit of a surprise. Obviously, they had a nice first week in New Orleans. But to go down to Dallas and beat them as badly as they did, that's got to be a little embarrassing for McCarthy.
Well, it is, but it's also setting the tone for their game hosting the Eagles this week. That's what I'm looking at. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up one thing on the Eagles, and that is you fellows are exactly right about no pressure. But I'll tell you, Carter and Davis, the two young men from Georgia, have not produced like is expected. Carter had a good year last year. And they say, well, Davis is still learning. The other thing is Vic Fangio is now the defensive coordinator. And a lot of that criticism has to go to him. But like you said, Roy, he might have just developed the wrong game plan for that. But anyway, yeah, that's Dallas. They got thumped. And that just tells me that the NFC South, with Tampa Bay and New Orleans, and now with the Falcons with their first win, it's an interesting group of three. Of course, Carolina, forget about it. They're out of there.
Roy, I would not be, totally shocked that New Orleans went down and won, but by the score and the way the game unfolded, I mean, they just wiped them out in the first half and coasted home. I mean, that was just totally amazing to me.
Well, it's kind of been amazing just what the Saints have done over the last 2 weeks, really, the first 2 weeks of the season. I mean, they have just been unstoppable, it seems, offensively, and it's just really kind of remarkable. I mean, it just kind of goes to show you that, like, I don't think a lot of people think that Derek Carr is in the top, 10 or 12 quarterbacks in the league. He's probably in the top, maybe in the top 15. He'd be in the top 20, but he's not one of those guys that you think is going to be able to go into a place like Dallas and do what he did last week. But he did, and that entire offense just looked very strong, unbeatable, and talk about not having an answer. I mean, we talked about that with the Eagles in the final drive against Atlanta. Well, Dallas had no answer for New Orleans, and again, it almost looked like they weren't prepared for the game. They had no idea what was what was coming to them. So
exactly,
quite surprised. Yeah, and look, that's why I think I know in Philadelphia, people are ready to jump out of buildings. But look, it's not that bad. Look around the division. Okay, the Giants are not anything to be too concerned about just yet at all. If they win, I doubt that they will be. They
never
might win 8 or 9 games, but they're not anybody that you should be concerned with. Commanders have a rookie quarterback who, like all the rookies, is struggling. And you got Dallas who just, let's face it, they're soft. That's a soft football team. And there are plenty of places where you can punch them and double them up. So, I think the Eagles are still the premier team in the division. I still think they'll win the division. You know, they took a tough hit last week, but they will come back from it. They'll learn from it. They'll probably be better for it. We may look back at this 10 weeks from now and say, hey, this was something that team needed to get back on the right track.
And the other team that really surprised me quite a bit, I would have thought they would have at least been 1-1 after two. Now, they had a really tough way to start. The Ravens, Roger. I mean, Harbaugh's done a terrific job down there in Baltimore, and I guess he right now is the longest reigning coach in the National Football League. But they have really played two really tough games. And on the bad side is they've come up short twice.
Well, yeah, you know, it's just amazing. Surprising because you're right. He has the stature, longest tenure with one team. Of course, Andy Reid, you know, he worked for Andy Reid if you combine, you know, both of the Eagles and the Cardinals. But, you know, I did want to say, just ask you guys one thing. I don't know whether you saw the Manning brothers towards the end of the game. Matt Ryan was on there the whole time, and they were busting him because he grew up as an Eagles fan and everything. He says, I live in Atlanta now, but there are so many bad analysts, okay, more at CBS, in my opinion, than at Fox. But I just thought he was a breath of fresh air, and the way he described certain things, because you got two other quarterbacks and they were, you know, talking about the way the Eagles fan, and Matt says to Eli, well, you faced them more than anybody, you know, the fans. But he gave some really good insight without being presidential to the Falcons, just good information. And I think that he has a very bright future as an analyst.
Roy, I got to be honest, I did not see any of that. I saw the game in its entirety, but I never switch off the game. I watch the game, and I never saw the Mannings, so I can't comment on that one.
Yeah, I didn't watch the Mannings either, but we're talking about Jason Kelce, right?
No, Matt Ryan.
Oh,
on there with the Manning brothers for like the fourth quarter, and they had Belichick on earlier in the game. But I just thought in that time, the way things were going, he really – I mean, when you got two other quarterbacks there, you know, that you're dealing with. But I thought he gave really good insight because, of course, neither one of them are analysts on TV, you know, and game analysts. And I thought he really showed that he would be an outstanding game analyst.
I agree. I think he will be. I mean, I've heard him do some work before as an analyst. He's done a couple of games, and I happen to see him. And he is good. Most quarterbacks are. Because, look, it's part of the job. You have to be able to articulate things, you know, in the huddle, in a moment. You have to be able to make, you know, snap decisions. I got to be honest. I haven't heard Tom Brady yet, guys. I don't know how good he is, you know, if he's bringing any energy. I get the feeling he's kind of feeling his way right now, that he hasn't quite figured out, you know, or maybe discovered, you know, what his voice is. But I'm saying that, again, not having heard him, but just having listened to him talk about the first couple of weeks. He was saying, you know, he was kind of saying the other day, they were asking him about some of the young quarterbacks struggling. He goes, hey, guys, playing quarterback in the NFL is hard. He says, being a first-year quarterback in the NFL is really hard. He said, you know what, being a first-year analyst is really hard too. So I get the feeling maybe he thinks that he hasn't hit his stride yet, and he probably hasn't. But either way, I thought you were talking about Jason Kelce, because he was on the broadcast as well. And I got to say this, guys, he was really good.
He is good.
Most of what we do here comes from quarterbacks. You think about it. Most of the analysts are quarterbacks. Or tight ends and that kind of thing. Well, Jason Kelce brings it from a different perspective, from the offensive line perspective, which when I was taught how to watch football, I was taught you watch the offensive line, you know, and you let your peripheral vision keep an eye on everything else. But you watch the offensive line, and he really broke some things down there, which were I thought were exceptional. And I think he brings a different perspective that we haven't heard before as well. I'd like to see him continue to get opportunities to develop his voice as an analyst, because I think, again, I think he can bring some very interesting viewpoints to the viewer that they don't normally get, you know, because the center is the one who's directing all the traffic there. You know, the quarterback's got his job as well, but the center, he's calling protections. He's looking at the line, at the defensive front, you know, trying to figure out what they're doing too. So I thought he did a really good job in his stint there as a bit of an analyst.
Well, there's one I can agree with you, Roy, because he did the whole third period, or most of all the third period, or third quarter of the game. And he did bring a great perspective to what was going on. And as you mentioned, as a 11, 12-year veteran with the Eagles, and as a center, that's where it all emanates from. They make all the calls and where the blocking goes, and he explained a lot of that during the course of it. So I would agree with you. I don't know whether Roger had a chance to see that or not.
No, I didn't see the third quarter because, I probably heard some of it. But I did see him on the earlier. I saw him at halftime. But I agree with you. But they also made a point that Hurts is now having to call all of the different assignments when he goes up to the line, whereas Kelce used to do all of that. So this
Correct.
Is all an adjustment period now for Hurts, too.
And I think the other thing is, as we look ahead to the season going down there, and they get more and more experience with the offensive line, because, you took away the juggernaut in the middle, and Roy, you just can't recover from that, especially when you don't do anything with the exhibition season.
Absolutely. But boy, oh boy, it didn't show on third and one and fourth and one, did it, guys? I mean, that push-push looked as good as it's ever looked. I got to be honest. I was thinking, are you going to the well here too often? I mean, they ran it four or five times in the second half alone. And I thought, man, are you going to the well too often here? I mean, they know it's coming. That's no soft offensive defensive front over there on Atlanta's side. They know it's coming. And yet they were still able to execute it. So, kudos to the Eagles. I mean, they certainly practiced that one up and got that one down. So they're not missing Jason Kelce there, and that's good for them.
Well, let me throw this out for both of you. Aaron Rodgers, did you have a chance to see him this weekend or was not televised in your area? Roger, we'll start with you.
I saw highlights, and that was it. But since we're talking about it on quarterbacks, let me just throw one out. Sam Darnold, what boy has he resurrected his career. And you think about what he went through with the Jets, right? And, was just considered that, at the on the trash pile. And boy,
right.
He's really resurrected his career, which I'm happy for him. But I only saw Aaron, and he did bring him back and win. And I only saw highlights. I didn't see the game.
Roy?
Well, I'll say this, Roger. If you had seen Aaron Rodgers, you might not have recognized him, because it's not the Aaron Rodgers that you'll remember. I remember an Aaron Rodgers who was, devastating outside of the pocket. That's where he was at his best, was making plays outside of the pocket, was scrambling. Creating opportunities for his receivers downfield, and he's just not that guy right now. I don't know if that guy's going to come back. Much like Kirk Cousins, coming off an Achilles tendon injury. And let's face it, look, guys, I had that injury, and it takes a long time to come back. Especially if you are not going to be out there running around. Within a year, it's going to take you probably 2 years to really overcome that. And I don't know that Aaron Rodgers has got 2 years left in him. But right now he's doing the best he can. He's not very mobile. He's kind of relying on his arm a little bit more than he used to, which is fine. And he's relying on his smarts and his savvy, which he's got plenty of. And that's why he was able to bring the team back. But for right now, now this could change. I mean, I'm sure he's working on it every day, but right now the mobility just isn't there, and we'll see if it develops over the course of the season. My guess is it will. It'll get better, but I don't know that it's ever going to reach the point where it was for him before. And that was, let's face it, that was one of his greatest weapons, was his ability to scramble out of trouble and still make
extend
a play.
The play.
Extend the play,
yeah.
Right.
And right now he's just he's lost some of that ability. He can still extend a play, but boy, he's got to step up, and he's just not as mobile. So we'll see if it how it goes. But he got one under his belt, so good for him.
Roy, before we switch over, one other thing for you, and that is that I thought the best part of his performance was, well, actually two ways. One, the fact that he threw the ball as hard as he threw it. And, I mean, boy, you better be able to catch the ball. If you're gonna be out there and Aaron Rodgers is going to throw it to you, you better have pretty good hands to hold on to, because, I mean, he was throwing bullets in that second half.
Well, you're right, and that's what you're seeing there is, again, that's always been part of his arsenal as well, is a great strong arm. But he's leaning on it more than ever now because he knows he can't make the plays outside. So he's, just mentally, he's compensating for the fact that I can't, scramble around and toss this thing. I've got to fire it, and everything's got to happen quicker. And when your brain is thinking that everything's going to have to happen quicker, well, you're just naturally going to throw the ball harder because you think you've got to get it there sooner. And whether you do or don't, the ball just going to come out harder. And that's just the brain compensating for the fact that he's missing part of his arsenal there, which is his ability to move around and create the opportunity for him to throw any pass that he wants. So that's part of it. But you're right. He's leaning on the arm more now than he ever has probably. Or at least hasn't, since his last lower body injury, if you want to take a hockey term from it. Bottom line is he did. He looked really good. And to me, I think very encouraging signs there for the Jets. I still don't think, they're not going to win that division unless something happens to Allen in Buffalo. But you know what? It's a sign that this team could have an interesting season, that they could win 9-10 games possibly if Aaron Rodgers stays healthy and at least has the opportunity to throw the ball, because if his line gives him that, he can still be dangerous.
Well, Roy, we're going to switch over to baseball. Steve Cannell is on the line, ready to go. I thank you very much, as always, for the first segment. We got a lot of information out there, and Roger, I'll tell you, it's a lot of fun to talk about the National Football League a few days after the Sunday and Monday games.
Never gets old. Never gets old. Have a great week, Roy.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Take care, partner. All right. Let's switch to baseball now. Steve is on the line with us. And Steve, our baseball aficionado. I want to first of all talk about tonight's game with the Philadelphia Phillies, because they have a pitcher who is pitching tonight, who they are going to rely very, very heavily, not only for, what make much difference for the end of the season, they've got too much of a lead. But when they get to the playoffs, Nola's got to pitch a lot better. He's pitched the last couple of times out. He's got, almost a 6.5 ERA, and he's given up a lot of runs, Steve.
Yeah, when you have your horse at the top of the rotation, you're number one and you're number two, you get to the playoffs, and you want them to be fresh and ready to go. So they'll probably do some management. And, the fact that he's been roughed up is probably just you'd hope is just a function of the grind of 162 catching up with him at the wrong time. So ease back maybe the last couple starts and then have him nice and fresh for the postseason.
Steve, let me get Roger in here first. You may have a question you want to jump on. I just wanted to get on the Aaron Nola pitching for tonight, because – I got it on the background. I just want to see how the Phillies are going to make out tonight with him on the mound. Go ahead, Roger.
Well, I agree. I am concerned, and also about the Ranger, because he's had some problems when he came back from being on the IL. And I think they need him. But, Steve, I don't know if you've seen Christopher Sanchez at all. He's really done well, and a real surprise.
Yeah, Christopher Sanchez, former Ray, was traded over to you guys, Philly, for Curtis Meade, and for a while was a very lopsided trade, and Sanchez, You know, there's two type of pitchers that make it in baseball, those that come right up and shine and those that get knocked around a little bit and then find something and turn it around. Sanchez found a little something. I want to say he his changeup and a little bit of a sweeper is what he added in there to go along with a nice 96-mile-an-hour fastball that cuts in on the righties. You know, when he found all that and put it together, he really took off. You know, the first go-around wasn't as exciting, but, you know, after he mixed in those pitches and, you know, got the innings under his belt. And, you know, what's interesting about Sanchez is he could play a nice role either, you know, as one of your starters in the postseason, or you wouldn't be surprised to see him come out of the bullpen and fire away. I assume they're going to start him in the postseason, but we'll see. That's a nice little arm to have.
Well, he was a big factor last year because when the Phillies sort of faltered a little bit, he came out and pitched well. And if it hadn't been for the back trouble, and I think Roger could confirm this, the first day of the season, I mean, he was really a very, very consistent pitcher game in and game out. But the back problem got him in trouble for about 5 weeks.
Yeah, that's true. And the other thing was that he gets you innings. He's had complete games.
Right.
And, boy, that takes a lot of heat off of the bullpen.
Yeah, I mean, that's in the postseason, like I say, that's another arm. Either save your bullpen or, you know, you can go a little bit if you're worried about Nola and he's not as sharp. You can cut him short and use your bullpen knowing that Sanchez can come out and give you innings. You know, and that's what the postseason's all about, how you mix and match. You know, we've seen – everybody here has watched a lot of baseball. We remember when there was Gilling and Johnson in Arizona that really carried them to a world championship, leaning on them. We remember when Ozzie Guillen said, I don't care about the bullpen, and leaned on his starters and won a world championship. We remember when Cleveland in 2016 lost all their starters and leaned on one guy in Corey Kluber and got all the way to the game 7 of the World Series. They didn't win it, but they basically were shorthanded in the rotation. So, you know, every manager, you look at your pitching staff, and as much as we want to focus on just one or two guys, really it comes down to how's the manager feel and how is he going to deploy everybody in the postseason. In the case of Cleveland, it was Andrew Miller and Corey Kluber were basically just throwing a ton of innings in the postseason. So, it's always interesting to me. The Phillies have a lot of arms in the bullpen and in the rotation, and however they decide to go about it, however Robbie Thompson attacks in the postseason, less than being able to go either direction.
Steve, let's take just a couple of minutes. Baltimore is really struggling for two reasons. One, they have just been decimated with injuries, and they just can't seem to get the ship straightened out after having a great, you know, three quarters of a year, which was very, very good going matching game for game with the Yankees, but the Yankees right now are starting to look like the Yankees were supposed to look. So any surprise there that Baltimore is just going to have to struggle into the playoffs?
No, I if you look at how teams perform in September, it doesn't really translate into the playoffs, you know. And then, you know, even the second half of the season, if you remember last year, Arizona got off to that great start. Then they played about 15 to 18 games under 500 for about a 50-game stretch, and then kind of straightened it out and limped into the playoffs and ended up in the World Series. On the other side, Texas wasn't a playoff team until the last day of the season where they got in, and then you look at the World Series and it was Texas and Arizona. It is something, you know, how to predict what's going to happen in the postseason in these shorter series and 5-game series and stuff. But how you perform in September, the fan base will feel much better if you're winning every game, of course. But there really is no correlation. Baltimore, if they can just, you know, they're going to have Zach Eflin and Corbin Burns as their 1-2 in the postseason and hope that those two can really horse through and get the offense going in the right direction and have the offense wake up again. Injuries suck. I hope that they can get a few guys healthy by the postseason. Like getting a Grayson Rodriguez back in any capacity would be fantastic.
Before I go to Roger, one last one in the East, and that's Boston. Very, very shocking that Boston has just fallen apart. But more importantly, the intentional pass they gave on Saturday afternoon. Just I've never seen anything like that in my life. Boston has just totally collapsed. They're having a tough time. And then wind up throwing at them. And I was a little surprised again that nobody was suspended or penalized at all for that. Those two things before I go to Roger.
Yeah, now that was New York that did the intentional walk, Gerrit Cole,
right.
Devers. And what made it so stark was the first time Cole hit Devers, and then he gave him the intentional walk, which leads you to believe that the hit by pitch in the first at bat was intentional. As much of an old school baseball guy that I am, I've mentioned before, I'm more Earl Weaver. You don't throw it, guys. It's to me, I really wish Major League Baseball would crack down more when it's so obvious that somebody was hit intentionally for a purpose. It needs to be taken out of baseball. And yes, I would like to see Gerrit Cole miss, instead of a 3-game suspension, give him a 6 or 7-game suspension, so he has to at least miss a start. But yeah, I was surprised. As far as Boston's collapsing, they look a little bit gassed in the rotation. They did have some injuries, as everybody else has. But when you have injuries and you don't have an upper-level farm system to really absorb the injuries, you kind of muddle your way to the end. And that's where Boston is. They're just kind of muddling their way to the finish line.
The only thing I would add to that was I think that the Red Sox manager should have been either fined or suspended a game, too. I don't think it should have just ended with Cole, but I agree with you. Roger?
Well, yeah, I agree. I think that when you have a situation like that, you've got to include the manager because he's calling the shots. And they're not doing things on their own, so to speak. But I getting back to what, Don, what you were talking about, and we've talked about it before with Doug, but I am shocked about the way the Orioles have taken a dip. And, I don't know whether they can recover or not, and which is sad because they were looking so good and was it just a tight pennant race in the AL East. But, maybe they will before the playoffs start.
Steve?
Yeah, that's, like I say, how you perform in the at the end of the season, sometimes it carries over, sometimes it doesn't. It's basically a new season. The Yankees will always have the one big problem. They're going to have it again this year, and that is if they're not hitting home runs, they're not scoring, and that bites them every single year. And you could say, well, it hasn't really bit them. They've been in the playoffs every single year. They haven't won a World Series now since, 2009? I know it's a sore subject to bring up, but we can always mention 2008 with the Rays. So, but I think the Yankees' last title was 2009, I believe. And a lot of that, they're in the playoffs every year. They look great. Everything's going. They got pitching. They got bullpen. Like last year the bullpen got injured, but they got pitching. And they have everything going, the karma that looks good, and then the home runs don't come in the postseason. And the next thing you know, unless they're playing the Twins, they're knocked out.
Well, you're much better on statistics than I am, and I will say this, that the Yankees have turned it around, but in your recollection, and you've been following it a long time statistically, have you ever seen 3 games in Chicago where the Yankees win 1-3-0, they win the second one 2-0, and the Cubs win the third one 2-1. So were that, and I grant you there was a big wind on Sunday especially, but have you ever seen Wrigley Field with 3 games like that?
Not this late in the season. Now, April and May, Wrigley Field is not fun to hit in. I'm sure you guys know that. It's not a good park to hit in.
Right.
May. But come on, June, July, August, September, generally the ball flies out of there. And that was that. Yeah, that's, again, though, with the Yankees, it's kind of their, what that kind of magnifies what I'm saying. They get to the postseason, and if Soto and Judge
Man, if you look at the numbers of when Soto and Judge get hits in a game versus when they don't, you know, it's the offense is completely different. So that'll be their big challenge. The good thing for the Yankees is that that bullpen has really been, other than Holmes having some issues, they have a lot of arms out there in that bullpen, similar to the Phillies, and that's another advantage in the postseason that'll help them, you know, just score a couple runs and then shut the other team down.
Exactly. And Soto got another home run last night, so he's in great shape for that 1-2 combination. Roger, you're up.
Hey, Don, yeah, I you know what, because you were at every game at the 1980 World Series, I was just thinking about it was Carlton and Lomborg, and then was the third Marty Bystrom, because he went 5-0 in September. I think you were there. I wasn't there.
I think you may be correct. I can't say that I remember it that well. I don't know. Maybe Steve knows better than I. I don't remember.
No, I just
1980 was a long time ago, Roger.
Look, Steve wasn't even born yet. Are you kidding?
little 10-year-old Steve was in front of the old TV watching the series with you know, Larry Boa and Steve Carlton, and I remember Tug McGraw. You know, I think
Tug McGraw was the force behind everything. You know, and he was with the Mets when they won. He was with the Phillies when they won, and I'll never forget the last game. And they took the pictures of Tug McGraw when he jumped up on the mound, and then the newspaper for some reason. Didn't get the picture they wanted, so they brought Tug McGraw out after it was all over, put him on the mound, had him jump up and down, and took pictures of him on the back of the Daily News the next day. Go ahead, Roger.
It shows you the way everything has changed.
Don't ever believe what you see.
No, exactly. Well, he jumped into Bob Boone's arms. That we know. I was just thinking about that, because I know, even going back to 64, if Mock had not used Chris Short and Art Mahaffey over and over and put Ray Culp in there, they might have won the pennant that year. They would have. That's history. But I'll tell you, Steve, you're big into baseball history. Me too, and I love that, talking to you all the time, because you always learn, and Don says the same thing talking to you. You always learn something new. But I do have a question about the worst team in baseball, the Chicago White Sox. And what is going to happen? They want a new stadium. They're never going to get a new stadium when they perform like this. What do you think is going to happen there?
You know, It's gonna be similar to the stories we followed in the past, you know, where these organizations are used to the bad publicity. Houston Astros did it, the Chicago Cubs did it, the Baltimore Orioles did it, and you just hope on the other side in 5 or 6 years, you know, it's gonna be a little bit longer. Fans are all happy, but I was very disappointed in Chris Getz answering questions from the media, and I was talking to a friend of mine about GMs, and this, you guys will enjoy this because it goes to Dave Dombrowski. I said, you know, Dave Dombrowski is a perfect GM or president of a large market team, because he understands not only the talent part of the game, but he understands how to talk to the fans. In Philadelphia, the fans don't want to hear about what's in AA and AAA in the wintertime. They want to hear about who they're going to get and who they're going to retain and what stars are you bringing in to compete. And he gets that, and he's been very good at it in everywhere.
Very good, yeah.
And if you're in a mid-market or a small market, you still also need to know how to speak to the fans, which means you can be transparent, but you can't be 100% what Chris Getz was. He was asked about the free agent market. Are you going to go out in the free agent market and add talent? Now, the answer to that question, if you're a GM, is we're going to explore all avenues of getting talent, because we can't have another year like we had this year. The team needs a talent infusion. We're going to search high and low to find players that fit the mold of what we're looking to accomplish to get more wins.
that's a standard GM answer to the fans. You know, you don't have to say no. He took the other path and just said, no, we're not going to go into the free agent market this year. We need the guys that we have in-house to do better. Now, I look at the standings after he said that, guys, and I don't know what you have in-house to expect to do better than what you're doing right now. So I don't know where he was going with that. And the other part of it was talking about trimming payroll. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you shouldn't be talking about trimming payroll and saying, yes, we're going to trim payroll. As a GM of that market, you need to be saying you're going to evaluate every player to improve the team to get victories. And I just really thought it was strange that it's really showed the inexperience of Chris Getz when you look at the other side of a Dave Dombrowski or an Andrew Friedman or Andrew Anthopoulos and how they answer questions in that gray area where they never really say anything, but they never really put their foot in their mouth.
Before I get to the, you know, whether you think the Dodgers with their payroll and the amount of money they have available, just the opposite of what you're saying about the White Sox and how much money they go over the limit with year in, year out, as the Yankees do the same. I'd just like to throw a few kudos at Cash. He didn't have great talent. He didn't have great – but I thought he kept Tampa Bay alive. I thought he did another good job of managing, even though he really didn't have a chance to manage the challenge for a playoff position. What would you think about that?
Yeah, this year was a very odd year in Tampa Bay. You know, again, injuries and poor performance. I mean, it starts with Randy Rosarena got off to a horrible start. Isak Paredes, after a good start, cooled off. Yandy Diaz never really got it going, you know, batting champ last year with 20-plus homers. The team never got going and never found that cohesive streak. I think Kevin Cash did a pretty good job. The way I define the Rays season was they were good but not good enough, and that led to a lot of bad outcomes, if that makes sense to you guys. Just a lot of games that were like 2-1 in the seventh inning, and, you know, whatever happened, and they would lose 5-2 or 5-3. Historically, bad.
Or extra innings. They'd go extra innings and lose. I mean, they played tough. They just couldn't win when they had to.
Yeah. Hey, here's an interesting thing. We were just talking about the 1980 Phillies, correct? And you were saying about how long ago that was. Well, this is kind of interesting for a Rays season. They have the lowest batting average with runners in scoring position since the 1981 New York Mets.
Wow.
That's amazing. Yes, when you put it in that term, that right there will define the season of just trying to figure out how this happened, where they got runners on base, they constantly had runners in scoring position, and they hit, I think right now they're at 216 on the year, if you can imagine that.
Terrible. Roger, you're up.
And I don't know how to manage that.
No. Oh, no, I mean, that statistic is just, to me, is just so surprising. I mean, I never would have thought it because, you know, I love watching the Rays, and I like the way they build a team and the way they compete, even though they don't draw many fans, but they've had good managers and they have a good manager and the organization. But then to hear that, it's no wonder that they're not going to be in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, it's been a really, like I say, when I said the term, they've played, you know, played good but not good enough, which led to a lot of bad outcomes. You know, when you look at the defense, the pitching, the bullpen, and getting guys in a position to drive runs home and then not driving runs home, that's leaving a lot of meat on the bone, a 216 average. And, guys, let me tell you, they're also, like, near the bottom of the league. I looked into it. They're in the bottom of the league in sacrifice flies. They're also not bringing home runs on double play balls. When they're getting the runners in scoring position, they're not even able to manufacture runs. So the 216 average is one thing, but they're also failing to just bring the runner from third home with less than two outs. They're one of the worst in baseball at that. You don't have to get a hit to do that. You just have to get the ball in the air or, you know, whatever, and they can't even do that this year. It's been really weird, gentlemen.
Well, you
see,
know
we got a lot
Steve,
of Philadelphia listeners on here, and so let me ask you this, too. The Phillies are an odd club. I mean, you saw what happened to them at the end of last year in the playoffs. Roger and I, of course, we track them almost every game. And you're in a situation here where the Phillies will score a lot of runs. They'll win 11-2, or they're like they did last night, what, 11-3? And then they'll go there the next night, and they'll strike out 14 times,
right,
and they'll score one run. I mean,
right,
it's a very, very unusual lineup and a very unusual characteristic of this ball club. Going into the playoffs, you don't know which way they're going to go.
Oh, that's what I was saying earlier. You just sometimes you never know. You know, that's why the big adage in baseball is that fielding and pitching basically travel more consistent than offense. Offense really can be quite streaky. You know, when back in 2020, the Rays offense, Randy Arozarena was Mickey Mantle-esque. You know, he broke out every record. The offense was hot, and the Rays ended up in the World Series. You know, and they got big hit after big hit. I mean, Chapman comes in to close, and Mikey Brasso hits a home run, and the Rays win that game. So when you get in the postseason, you're right. You really want Philadelphia offense to show up and have that, you know, what you see in the season, maybe a 7 to 10 to 12 day or longer, really, explosion. Here in Tampa Bay, we've seen the opposite the last couple of years. The offense has put up about 3 runs in the 4 games that they've played in the postseason. So I would get it. And if your offense is cold in the postseason, it makes it very difficult to advance to the next round.
Roger?
Yeah, I've just the one of the things when you were just talking about how inconsistent the Phillies can be, so inconsistent. I just wonder the art of bunting, you know, to generate runs. I know they're working with Johan Rojas because he could use the speed. But I can remember as a kid, listening to a radio broadcast of the Phillies against the Pirates with Robin Roberts on the mound in the ninth inning, and the Pirates bunted 4 times to get the winning run. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And it just goes to show you what the art of bunting can do. But today, very few managers or the strategisticians, the technology people, want to use the art of bunting, and that's really a shame. I love to see small ball, but we don't see much of it in the major leagues anymore.
Yeah, you know, it's you're talking to the wrong guy about this. I would never bunt to save my life unless you're bunting for a hit. I don't want to see sacrifice bunts. I don't want to see giving up. That's not me. But for you, the A's just did a 3 bunts. In consecutive bunts last week in a row. They had runners at first and third. They laid down the bunt. The run scored. They came home. The guy was safe. The runner from first went over to third, so they had first and third again, and they got another run on a bunt, and then they bunted again. So 3 straight bunts.
There you go.
And that was it. And that was pretty nice. Now, in the bottom of the inning, the other team, you know, hit 2 home runs, and, you know, it didn't really make a difference in the game. But they did get that run home, and that was good. Some people like the bunt. I can't stand it. Like I say, I'm Earl Weaver. You know, you have 27 outs, and you never give one away. You just don't do it. You know, it's just not worth it. You know, having the bat in your hands is the most important thing on offense, and taking the bat out of the hands is not. And that's me. But I understand other people think, you know, if you have a runner at second and nobody out in a tie game in the 8th inning, you want to lay down the bunt and get them to third, and then you can bring them home with a ground ball or a fly ball. In the postseason, you might see it. And the team that does it might get that run in the ninth inning and then close it down. It's always a different game in the postseason. You know, there's a reason why every team tries to find that speedster guy that can bunt.
I'd rather wait and see who my hitter is, because if I got a hitter – they can't control the bat. My preference is, and I agree with Roger, I'm a big guy for bunting also, but not many guys can bunt now. So, you know, It doesn't happen very often. I mean, I saw Bomb try to, not Bomb, it doesn't make any difference. But anyway, if you got a guy get hit the ball to the right side, I'd much prefer to either try to hit the ball to the right side, move the guy, and maybe get a base hit at the same time, sending him to third base, or at best, at worst, get him to third base. They don't even do that. They take the same cut on strike one, on strike two, on strike three. It doesn't even look like they know where right field is.
Well, yeah, with today's pitchers throwing 95, 96 miles an hour and cutting it in and moving it around. And if you haven't noticed, crash so hard on bunts now, the wheel play, you can visualize, Anthony Rizzo coming down the first baseline and covering, the third baseman doesn't even come in. They bunt to the third base side, and Rizzo's the one that gets it, and they get the runner without a problem. I think more guys are thrown out on bunts now than ever before in baseball history. Even the guy going from first to second, sometimes they just throw down and get the force play. I think a lot of it has to do with the pitchers are so nasty with the movement and the pitches that they're throwing up there. You can't play pepper at bat anymore. That's almost impossible, to try to just play pepper and, cut your swing down and put the ball in play and hit it the other way to the second baseman. It's so difficult. There's not many guys that can play pepper in the batter's box anymore. But interesting, we'll keep an eye on it, and maybe we'll see a moment in a Philly game in the postseason where I don't know if you guys brought anybody in to be that role player. Like last year on the taxi squad in the first round of the playoffs, believe it or not, the Rays had brought in Billy Hamilton. Just in case, say, they advance to the next round, he would fill that role. There's only one reason you're bringing Billy Hamilton onto your roster, and that would be, in the event of a bunt or a stolen base, pinch running, and stuff like that. So, it's very interesting to see without being able to expand the rosters, you don't see that too much anymore. Who was it that was up every year for like a decade? Terrence Gore?
Roger?
Yeah, I think you're right about that, I think the other factor, and I can't stand it, but the phantom runner at second base when you go to extra innings. And, that's
where I
think...
Is that going to hold true in the World Series, Roger? Are they going to do that in the World?
Steve?
It's like hockey's 3-on-3. It goes away in the playoffs. The whole idea is to have is just to stop the players love it, and the teams like it because, when you have a 16-inning game, you're probably going to make two roster moves after the game. You're going to send down two pitchers and call up two fresh pitchers, and it gets kind of crazy. That was the main impetus behind not having 16, 18-inning games. These teams were sometimes in the course of a month, you end up making 14, 15 roster moves because of extra innings. And I think they just wanted to get rid of that out of the game. It could go away in the future. Who knows? I mean, hockey 3-on-3 doesn't exactly say that hockey is, taking the regular season with a grain of salt for, tie game after three periods. You go 3-on-3.
Steve, I want to thank you very much, as always. And I'll tell you, we're going to get you on because we get close to the World Series. And one quick answer, do you give the Dodgers the nod going into the National League or with all the talent they have, not only on the roster, but sitting in the background just waiting to come to the fore some year? Do they give the Dodgers
my pick will probably be the Dodgers and Yankees because that's the World Series I've been wanting to see since I was a kid in 1980s. I would love to see that kind of like Dodger Stadium and Yankee Stadium forefront, the blue and white Dodger iconic jersey versus the pinstripes. But the main thing about the postseason is now I really want to see the situation come up in Philadelphia with the bunt. I have to see it so we can talk about it.
Thank you very much, Steve. We're going to, as I say, we'll get you.
Take care, Steve. You're the best.
We'll get you right in there for the World Series. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Trevor Bosco is sitting on the sidelines waiting. And, Trevor, my first question to you, give me your evaluation of Love as the quarterback of the Commanders. And number two, did you see much of the Giant Commander game over the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they didn't score a touchdown. The Commanders relied on 7 field goals to win the game, which is more pathetic on the Giants' half. Daniel Jones actually, I think he threw his first touchdown in over a year. He didn't look too bad compared to, you know, what we saw, you know, in week one. But, no, I really like the Commanders. I like Jaden Daniels. He's the only quarterback in the NFC East without an interception right now. Playing clean, conservative football. Dan Quinn, I mean, he's going to play smart football there. They got to turn the organization around. Starting 1-1 is better than what a lot of people expected from them.
Well, before I throw it to Roger, I want to tell you one thing. I saw a replay of the Giant game, and I'll tell you, when you turn the ball over 5 times with illegal procedure inside the 20-yard line, you're not going to win very many games. And yet Washington did exactly that. Turned it over 5 times inside the 20-yard line and still came away with a win over the Giants for 2 reasons. One, the Giants had no kicker to combat the field goals that were executed by Washington. And number two, it was just incredible to watch what was happening. How Washington won that game, I just can't believe it. I mean, just kicking all those field goals and winning the game. Roger, you're up. Go ahead.
Well, you know, we talked about it earlier, Trevor. Some of the quarterbacks that have looked really good, and the one I'm really happy for is Sam Darnold. I mean, he really has looked good, and especially after he came out of the crash heap, you know, after his experiences earlier in his career. Do you follow him at all?
No, I mean, Sam Darnold's an interesting case. I mean, the Jets failed him. The Panthers failed him. He got 1 year with Shanahan, and, you know, and that probably definitely resurrected his IQ of the game. And then the Vikings gave him that prove-it deal, and he's balling out right now. I mean, obviously it's only week 2 going into week 3, so overreactions are still prevalent. But the Vikings look like they're, you know, going to be a very solid competitive team this year. They outcoached Shanahan and the 49ers this past weekend. Darnold's looking good. Justin Jefferson's set to play this weekend despite the injury this past week. But I'm excited for the Vikings. I'm scared as a Lions fan. But another guy that's playing insanely right now is Baker Mayfield. I mean, he looks exceptional. He didn't light up the stat sheet against the Lions, but, you know, those pivotal rush plays up the center and that rushing touchdown was crucial for the Bucs to pull away and with a pivotal win in Ford Field, which is crazy. But they got the revenge game from their, you know, divisional playoff loss last year in Detroit, so that's good for them. They're trending in the right direction. That's honestly, in my opinion, Todd Bowles' best called game of his entire NFL head coaching career. He was stellar. The red zone defense was amazing, especially their injuries they had. Vita Vea going down in the game. They came through adversity. It was very impressive. The Bucs, they stood out to me more than probably any other team this weekend, to tell you the truth.
I was going to say, would that be your number one surprise of the weekend? Because everybody was looking, you know, at what we talked about in the first segment of the show tonight. Everybody's looking for, you know, Detroit to be the cream of the crop and get back to the playoffs and deep into the playoffs and not the Super Bowl. And yet it just didn't turn out that way this particular weekend. Was there anything else that surprised you besides that game?
No, I mean, the Bucs winning, I mean, it definitely was a shocker because they were the underdog, but that's a good team. Baker's a good quarterback playing genuinely at an MVP level right now. But the biggest shocker of week 2 was the Raiders beating the Ravens. The Ravens are spiraling right now, and it's weird to see that Gardner Minshew looks exceptional. Max Crosby in that defense is playing very well. The Raiders are a team to look forward to. I mean, Antonio Pierce has those guys playing very well right now.
Roger?
Well, he did a good job coming in last year, you know, as the interim. And I've always thought that, you know, he was a great linebacker for the Giants with a number of other great linebackers and defensive players. But I've been just like Dave Campbell. I'm a big fan of Dave Campbell, and I think Antonio brings the same energy to the Raiders that Dave Campbell does.
Yeah, no, I agree. They have that grittiness and that intensity to them, and that player coach system, it seems to be working. And Dan Campbell is definitely the definition of that. And I want to just talk about him. He, you know, said after the game that he cost them this game. He did. Truthfully, the mismanagement of time towards the end of the first half, not getting your field goal unit out there on time, just a huge blunder there, 3 points that could have swayed the game. But he takes ownership on that, and not a lot of guys do. And not they're not upfront about it. And he's probably right now, in my opinion, one of the most passionate coaches in the game of football, just because you can see it everywhere he goes. But I'm not worried about the Lions. We lost the game to the Seahawks early last year. I think we're still a really good team. We just got to, you know, bounce back and develop that offensive rhythm. Ben Johnson needs to turn things around and get the run game more prevalent. Jahmyr Gibbs and David Montgomery are a great dynamic duo. Jared Goff throwing the football 55 times in a game is not a recipe for any team to win. Another game I want to talk about, a very controversial one, was the Bengals versus the Chiefs game. Although that last play was correct, in my opinion, it was PI. He did make that contact and touch the back of his helmet and rub up against him. I know people are going to say, no, you can't do that. But he did disrupt the receiver from attempting to make the catch. You can't do that. But there were plays prior that were just horrible no calls on some of the Bengals defensive linemen, guys that were genuine horse callers. No flags, none of that. So the refs this past weekend, in my opinion, were really rough. There was also a huge no-call on Jameson Williams getting literally tackled before the ball was even thrown, and it ended up in an interception, no-call there. The refs really got to get better. It's going to hopefully clean up, but it's the NFL. Does it ever, you know, at least as of late.
I agree with you 100% on Cincinnati. I thought they got jobbed a few times in that game, and they tried to protest as much as they could without, you know, getting an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. But, you know, they really brought it to the fore. And if you were watching the game on television and replays, you saw that some of the calls were just not 100%. How about the Rams, though? I mean, they had a very tough first two games of the season, and all of a sudden they're gasping for air.
So their biggest issue right now is truthfully injuries. I know they're getting one of their offensive linemen back, but Cooper Kupp going down that's a huge demoralization. Puka Nacua should be back within 3 weeks, but still, what is that going to help you with when you have no line to protect Matthew Stafford? They looked abysmal this past weekend. The Cardinals dismantled them. I want to talk about Kyler Murray also throwing for a perfect passer rating, 158. Beautiful game by him. They look stellar. Marvin Harrison Jr., 4 catches, over 100 yards, and 2 touchdowns. He looks like the beast he thought he was going to be. But the Rams, they do not look like they're going to be trending any higher than what they were after that beautiful week one performance they gave, even in a loss. But they just don't look like they're going to be that competitive again, maybe till later this year. But never count Sean McVay out, because he's one of the, you know, best head coaches in the league. But this roster that he has right now is just – it's torn apart, injured, and just abysmal.
Roger?
Yeah, how much of that goes back to a few years ago when they made the Goff-Stafford trade? Of course, they won a Super Bowl, but they've had problems ever since. They looked last year like they were on the right track. But you feel, Trevor, they have regressed this year so far? Like you said, it's early. But what do you think?
I mean, obviously, without Aaron Donald, that's a huge loss in general. Their defense will never be the same without his presence. But overall, I think injuries are just destroying this team currently. I mean, no matter who they have, Sean McVay has a good scheme that's going to put these guys in a position to succeed. But, you know, in general right now with the guys they have, I think their top two receivers right now are going to be Tyler Johnson, and I don't even know their next up. So that's a concern. You know, and hopefully Puka gets back. But they did regress, and they have regressed ever since that Super Bowl. They did get to the playoffs last year, but from Super Bowl to a playoff appearance, that's definitely regression. But, you know, that trade, they definitely sold their future for that ring. It was worth it, obviously, but
sure.
Since then and going forward, it's not going to be very sunny in L.A., in my opinion. I think the Chargers are going to be the better L.A. team going forward.
Trevor, I've got to get your evaluation of New Orleans, because they surprised a little bit the first week of the season. They surprised. But the second week of the season, they shocked. I mean, not only did they win, but the way they controlled the first half of the game and then just walked away with it in Dallas, I mean, it was unbelievable to me.
Yeah, no, they dominated in every aspect of the game. Dallas, I don't know what's going on with Dallas. Was Cleveland just that horrible week one that they were able to dominate them, or were they just, you know, that good in week one? Was it just an anomaly? But, yeah, Dallas looks completely different. Apparently CeeDee Lamb has an ankle injury, so that's concerning. But, you know, the Saints, definitely a shocker going into the first 2 weeks of the league. I think they've scored over 90 points in 2 weeks, which is a record, I think. Which is crazy. Derek Carr looks 100%. Raheed Shaheed is a guy you want to remember. Alvin Kamara is a touchdown machine. They have a good offense. Dennis Allen looks to have some swagger right now, which is rare because normally, I don't know, I just never really got a good impression from him. But, I mean, he's starting out hot. But we've seen this before. We've seen them go 8-1 with Jameis Winston, and it just falls apart. So I need to see it to believe it, but they are putting up really good numbers and beating really decent opponents. So they're proving a lot of people wrong.
Philly's up 1-0 in their game. Roger, you're up.
Well, if you look at the Cowboys, Dak signed his new contract, right? And then they floundered. So, you know, and then Lamb, same thing. I mean, he got a new contract too. But I just was shocked about that. But then you have to think maybe – this is the real deal, and the Saints are back in the hunt, which, you know, since they had the coaching change. I mean, it has not been a pleasant time down in New Orleans. But you think they will turn? I mean, that they will go down, or do you think that they are a team for contention, Darryl? Treble.
In my opinion, the Bucks. It's the Bucks division right now until we see otherwise. But the Saints could be a contender. But you know, based on patterns and just their history with Dennis Allen, I imagine you know they're going to start off really hot and maybe appear in the playoffs. But I just don't know if they have the depth and the roster to compete with the Bucks and even the Falcons. The Falcons, top to bottom, have a way better roster, in my opinion, than the Saints do. But the Saints are overachieving right now, and that might come to an end. But definitely a streak that I would continue to ride on because they've proven otherwise. The Dallas Cowboys have a good defense. So, you know, you can't sleep on that performance by any means.
Trevor, the interesting, we talked about it a little bit in the first segment of the program tonight. Aaron Rodgers, how would you evaluate what Aaron Rodgers did to get the Jets a win?
I mean, it's crazy to even say that Aaron Rodgers got his first win as a New York Jet. That sentence never, you know, I never imagined that would come out of my mouth, but it looked decent. It looked kind of weird at times, but they definitely performed when needed. Breece Hall had a really nice catch in the end zone, but I respect the gritty win for sure.
Roger?
Yeah, well, we talked about it earlier, and I think that that Roy hit the nail on the head. I mean, Rodgers is not the Aaron Rodgers of even 3 years ago. I mean, he had the injury. It's a long recovery period. But the one thing that I noticed in the little bit that I've seen, and Don, you've seen a lot more, and you probably have too, Trevor, he is not able to push off on the back foot like he used to, and that we saw so many times on those comeback games in the last 2 minutes or so. Am I wrong about that, or did you notice the same thing?
No, I mean, I agree with you. I feel like, you know, everything in his, you know, physical game has probably regressed a little bit due to degree and age, but he also just doesn't have that same team. He doesn't have that same, and it's weird being in a new place and, you know, finally getting, you know, started, because, you know, last year was such kind of a series of unfortunate events for the Jets, let's just say that. But, you know, going into this season, obviously week one was a disappointment. They did have a tough opponent, you know, in the 49ers, so it wasn't like the NFL schedule makers were going easy on them or anything, but I think they'll get into groove. I don't know if this is a playoff winning team. I still think Aaron Rodgers has that clutch ability. He still has the IQ. He can still win games, obviously. But I'm concerned about the longevity of not only the team around him, because they continuously go through injuries as well, and their defense is kind of underperforming. They did play well in week two, but I don't think we can confidently say, like, and this might even be a hot take, that Aaron Rodgers could take this team further than it's expected to. Like, I don't think he can put it on its back like he was in Green Bay, if that makes sense.
I'll agree with that 100%. I think the other thing is that they surprised me a little bit. They're 6.5-point favorites tomorrow night against the Patriots. Now, the Patriots were supposed to be the bottom of the barrel going into the season. They played a great first game and won it. They played a pretty good second game and, you know, weren't blown out by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, okay, they play three in a row and they win and go up against Rodgers and the Jets tomorrow night and you know, get over that 6.5-point spread? Or why do you see that one, Trevor?
That one's a tough one. I would stay away from, you know, any spreads or over-unders on this one. I just feel like this could either be, you know, very one-sided or very chippy and close. The Patriots, they have a well-coached defense. It's stout. It's bend, don't break. It's what we're used to from them. Rod Mayo is having a nice start to his debut season. But I'm still going to take the Jets because, like, Robert Saleh, he needs to win these primetime games. Like, his, in my opinion, his job is on the line if they don't at least get one playoff, like a wild card win, at least. That's a tough conference. I understand that. But with what this team is, the roster, where it's at, and you have Aaron Rodgers, you should expect nothing less than a playoff win or two. But they should hopefully win this game if you're a Jets fan. But it definitely could be chippy. It could be close, like 20-23. You know, maybe even lower than that. But, yeah, I'm going to take the Jets.
Roger?
Okay. What I want to do right now is what we used to do in this show years ago with Tommy and your grandfather, where we would pick the games. And I would love to do that, okay? New England, like Don said, with the Jets, both 1-1. Okay, Trevor, we'll go right down the line. Let me get your prediction. Who's going to win?
That's a tough one. I really don't know. I'm kind of torn on that, to tell you the truth. What are your guys' thoughts? Let me gauge the room here.
I think the Jets will win it only because they're playing at home and you know the Patriots have had two very, very good games the first two games of the season. I don't know that they're going to win by 6.5 points, but I really think if all goes well and nobody gets hurt, I pick the Jets to win tomorrow night.
Okay, Eagles.
Yeah,
Saints.
I agree.
Okay, Eagles Saints. I pick
Eagles,
the Jets too.
Eagles,
go ahead, Eagles Saints.
Let me see. I mean, we expect the Eagles to bounce back and regroup. It definitely was a tough loss, to tell you the truth. I was not, because like I went to bed and I was like, oh, they're up. They're not gonna lose. There's 31 seconds left, and then, you know, we saw what happened. And I also heard that Nick Sirianni and none of the coaches addressed the team after the loss. So that's pretty telling to what's going on in the locker room there. I think they need to win this game. I'm going to take the Eagles because of just the severity of, like, them needing to bounce back after that. And let me just give you guys some numbers. Since 2023, they have blown four leads within the two-minute warning, and they've also given up 176-plus points in the two-minute warning. So they definitely need to get their coaching back into a higher standard, and their defense needs to get on par because it's been a joke. And Nick Sirianni needs to be held accountable for that. And I think they'll win, though, just out of sheer pressure. They have to. And I think the Saints will probably get a reality check, too.
Well, they're a 3-point underdog, Eagles are right now, and 49.5 points is the over-under. I got to go with the Eagles. I just think they've scored a lot of points down there in New Orleans in the first two games, both in Dallas and, of course, the first game of the season. I think the Eagles almost have to win early in the season. I think they almost have to win this game.
I agree they have to win, but I'm going to take the Saints because they're at home. Okay, next, Giants at Cleveland. Giants 0-2, Cleveland 1-1. I'll take the Cleveland only because – not because of Deshaun Watson, let me tell you that. I just think that because they're home, they'll rally and beat the Giants. Go ahead.
I wouldn't be surprised at that, but we got Mike standing by. We got to jump over to a little soccer, a little football,
okay.
Down in the Baltimore, Washington area. Trevor, once again, thank you very much. I'll let you get one word in. You like the Giants or you like Cleveland?
Give me the I was going to say the Giants. Give me the Cleveland Browns at home in a clear win. But thank you guys for having me on. Greatly appreciate it as always. Love you guys. Take care.
You got it, partner.
I got to
say the same thing. I think Cleveland. I can't imagine the Giants beating anybody after watching them last week. All right, let's get down to Baltimore right now. Baltimore, Washington area where Mike Simczak is standing by. We normally talk soccer. A lot of soccer news going on right now. But I want to talk to him about that Washington game over Sunday. The Commanders, I saw a replay of it with the Giants game, and I talked about it earlier in the show. And, you know, I think Love did a great job at quarterback for Washington. He got them the win almost single-handedly. But how could you have that many illegal procedure calls inside the 20-yard line and win a game? Yet they did. Mike?
That has been a theme for the last 2 weeks. It's been just a clear number of penalties, illegal procedures, false starts, all that sort of stuff. And you hear Dan Quinn and Cliff Kingsbury talking about the fact that that's something that they clearly need to clean up. It's, I think, a little different when you have a line that might have, you know, one new guy or you bring in a new quarterback and you've got to get used to the new cadence and things like that. But pretty much everybody is new. They replaced, two-thirds? You got a new center. You got two new offensive linemen. You've got a new quarterback. You've got a new play caller. So I can understand that there's still a little bit of growing to be done. And the fact of the matter is that as a unit, they didn't play a ton in the preseason. So I think that they're going through these adjustments right now.
Roger?
Well, I saw the other day, and we've talked about it, the coaches that did play the starters during the preseason have had success. And why these other coaches that don't do it don't follow suit. And the Steelers go to away for training camp, and then the Chiefs go away. Dallas goes away too, but they go far away, California. But there's a couple of other teams that go in the old system. I really think that that's what more teams need to do. I don't care about the money. The cost, listen, they're making so much money in the NFL, and the league got half of what the revenue was on that São Paulo, Brazil game, and the players got half. And, you know, it was multi-millions of dollars. So I see no reason why they don't take these teams and go back to colleges. I don't care about interfering with the colleges. A lot of these colleges have complexes now that, I mean, if you go, you know, the Steelers, one of the reasons they go to St. Vincent's is because Pitt, and if you've ever been there, University of Pittsburgh and the Steelers, their training operation is in the same building, one on one side, one on the other. I mean, it's unbelievable. They don't have a big, expansive system or a location like some of the teams. I mean, the Eagles is right across the street, but it's, you know, a big piece of property. So, anyway, that's my opinion for what it's worth.
Roger, I will agree with you wholeheartedly on the playing in the preseason. I think that the coaches really have to look. They say that they like to close practices because they can manage situations and they get the game feel, but it's a controlled environment and the hitting and stuff like that. But I think that it just seems to me that I wouldn't want my preseason, my warm-ups for an uncontrolled environment to be in a controlled environment. Mostly what they're saying is they don't want to expose these guys to the risk of injury in the preseason. Mm-hmm. And so the cost of doing that is the preseason, and it takes a couple of games for the guys to get it together. I can understand the wanting to stay closer to the facilities because, you know, the trade-off is the camaraderie. The guys all sleep in the dorm rooms and sort of that sort of stuff. But the benefit is they have access to the nutrition, the weight room, the facilities. I think the facilities that these teams have at the training complexes, that's what they really want them to be able to, the training, all of that sort of stuff. So I can understand wanting to stay close to home, especially when you paid all of this money to build it. You might as well get as much use out of it as you can. Some teams have nicer facilities than others. I know that Ashburn, where the Commanders are, isn't exactly the nicest facility. For a lot of years, they went down to Richmond up until very recently. The last 4 years, COVID time frame, they were going down to Richmond, but actually the city of Richmond was paying them like $500,000 a summer to come down, and that deal ran out, so they've been staying. But it's become another way, you know, you can charge fans to come to training camp, and it's just another revenue maker, that part. But I do think that not playing guys in the preseason and not playing the players in the preseason is why you're seeing a lot of these penalties, these slow starts, these mistakes to start the year, because they're not really game ready. They haven't figured out everything, so it's hard. And that's why, you know, the teams that have got some playing time, they've got a leg up the first couple of weeks.
Mike, you've had a chance to look at the first couple of games. First of all, your evaluation of the young quarterback, as I said at the top of our conversation here, I thought he did a heck of a job under some very, very adverse conditions. Every time he got near the goal line, they kept screwing him up. But your evaluation on him, and number two, I thought they had a really nice crowd there Sunday. I don't know if it was a complete sellout, but it looked pretty full to me on television.
Yeah, I think it was. I think that this crowd was a little bit surprised a lot of people with the size and the fact that there weren't those big swaths of blue that people were expecting to see. There's still a lot of like excitement, I guess is kind of a word. There's still a lot of good feeling around the change in ownership, even if people are starting to realize that the team on the field this year isn't necessarily that good. They're still excited about the team, the change in the culture, the attitude towards it. So there's a lot of goodwill that has been built up towards Josh Harris and Dan Quinn as of right now. How long that's going to continue, I don't know. I think if the team struggles, you'll start to see the attendance drop. As far as Jaden Daniels, I think through his first two games, he has been decent. You haven't seen him have sort of that takeoff that a C.J. Stroud had. But remember last year, even C.J. Stroud had a couple of bad games early, and then towards the middle of the season really started playing well. But he also hasn't had the catastrophic games that Caleb Williams or Bryce Young have had. So he's only one of a handful of quarterbacks right now who has zero interceptions. He's sitting around, I think, 18th in the league in yards. He's playing, taking care of the football. He's been able to move the football, although he's done more of it with his legs than anything else. They're playing a very conservative game plan, lots of swing passes, lots of short passes. He's not pushing the ball downfield. They don't have a lot of weapons, people who you would look at and say they have a lot of game changers on offense. You know, Terry McLaurin is probably the biggest one, and he has barely touched the ball. I don't even think he has 40 yards receiving yet this year. If they want to press the ball towards him, he might be able to. He's one of the few guys who can create. But I think Jaden has shown you he's developing. He's learning game by game. And as long as he's got the mentality to protect the football, he's got the ability to run, he's able to create without causing catastrophe. So he'll develop. There's still a lot of positive potential, and it's only two games into his professional career. There's a lot to like there.
Roger?
Yeah, I wanted to ask one question before we get away from football, because you're and Doug would know too. The Ravens are also a team that goes to a college, aren't they?
No, they stay local.
Oh, did they? Didn't they used to go?
I think they're still out. I'm pretty sure, unless something radically changed, I'm pretty sure they're still out in Owens Mills.
Well, yeah, but didn't they go to that college that's out there on? What is that, Route 70 or 270 that goes out to the Pennsylvania Turnpike? What is that?
Yeah, that
I forget. Is that
70,
Western Maryland?
Yeah, that's out in Western Maryland in 70. But my recollection this year, recollection for the last couple of years, at least since COVID, they've stayed local. They've stayed at the Bowman's Mills.
Okay. Well, I know we're going to talk about soccer, and I saw some highlights in part of one game, but also the Union lost the other. I guess it was over the weekend. So, can we stay with football? You want to go to soccer?
It doesn't matter. We can talk about more about the Commanders and the Ravens. You know, we can talk about the Union. They had a.
Let's touch on the Union first. Then we'll come back to football. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, they got messied on over the weekend.
Saturday.
Lionel Messi returned from a leg injury and proceeded to score, I think, 2 goals in 4 minutes against the Union, and it was a 3-1 Miami win. So the Union are back in action tonight. Right before I got on the air, they were up 3-0 against NYCFC. I don't think that they have scored again. So looking for kind of a bounce-back performance, I guess, after a really, really, really hard loss over the weekend.
Well, we'll go back to the football for a minute. Some of your observations on some of the other games other than what the Commanders did and what you look forward to for the Commanders this weekend.
Well, the Commanders have the Monday night game against the second of the two Monday night games against Cincinnati out in Cincinnati. I don't think that they are quite there yet. Joe Burrow is looking for that win. He's looking to get the offense moving. We haven't seen Jamar Chase really emerge since he got the new contract and ended his holdout. So you've got a upset Jamar Chase, a Joe Burrow who's looking for, looking really in desperate need of a win to jumpstart his season.
And they're 7.5-point favorite. Cleveland's 7.5-point favorite in the game.
And a Washington Commanders team that has no edge rush and is really, 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 really bad in the secondary. I don't know what the over-under on yards for Jamar Chase is, but I think I'm taking the over. And I really don't care what that number is. I think he's going to have a field day. That Bengals offense is going to have a field day against the Washington defense. You know, we'll see what the offense can do. This was a big this game this week against the Giants. That was almost as much of a must-win as you can have. They needed to get a win against a team that looked as bad as the Giants just for proof of concept. But this is still not a team that in the Commanders that is more than probably a 6 or 7 win team, if that. So I think that they're going that the Bengals are just a bridge too far for them on Monday. Up to 95, the Ravens also desperately need a win, and they've got to go down and face a Cowboys team that just got embarrassed by a pretty decent Saints team.
That's going to be a tough game.
That's going to be a really, really, really tough game, and it's just not clicking right now for the Ravens with Derrick Henry. And the they are another team that had a lot of pieces. We talked about the players that they lost this offseason with the likes of Jadeveon Clowney, who had a really good season for them, Patrick Queen moving on. Nate Wiggins, the quarterback that they picked up, he's going to be out. They lost some pieces on their offensive lines. They're bringing in some new rookie linemen. It's another case of a team that just that they really haven't clicked yet. You got to be surprised that a team that builds its reputation on defense the way that the Ravens do would be the one to give up a drive to Gardner Minshew, of all people, late in the game to lose. They just don't do that, especially in Baltimore.
Roger.
I don't really know how to call this Cowboys game, but I think that's going to be a really interesting battle between two teams that are desperately in need of a win.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Mike. And I would say the Cowboys because they're at home. But listen, John Harbaugh's been through some tough encounters over many years. And, when he was with the Eagles, they were playing Dallas down there every year, and I'm sure I know he's played against the Cowboys with the Ravens many times, or at least several times. But I think the Cowboys, because of the home field advantage, are going to win the game.
1.5 game spread, 1.5 point spread of that game. And one thing I like to first of all compliment you, Mike, because you hit the nail on the head when you talked about this. The weakness of the Commanders out on the corners. I mean, the Giants, a good quarterback is going to take great advantage of Washington in terms of their outside coverage. They don't double cover well. They don't single cover well. And I think a guy like Burrows is going to rump. He's going to put a lot of points on the board throwing against that defense.
And there's no – remember, the only pass rush that they're getting is coming from the interior. They don't have much
right.
On the edges at all. This is a defense that's really a work in progress, and they put some Band-Aids on it this year. But Dan Quinn's got to be looking at that. And so I think that he realizes that the task that he has right now to overhaul that defense, Ron did not leave him with much in the way of just talent. And I would say the only thing that you got right now is the two interior linemen, Payne and Williams. They just don't have, or Jared Allen and William and Deron Payne, like those are your real talented guys. They don't have anything at the linebackers. The corners, the secondary has just looked awful. They spent a high first-round draft pick on Emmanuel Forbes last year. He's down with an injury, but he was probably going to get benched. The guy that they brought in, Mike Davis, the cornerback that they brought in to fill in for Forbes, was so bad, he got benched. Mikey Samuelsill, who was the guy they drafted this year, there were a lot of questions about his height. He hasn't been necessarily good. It's a mess.
Roger?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, we talked about the Eagles game. Let's talk about the Eagles game with you, Mike.
They're going to go down to New Orleans. They're 1-1 after that big loss on Monday night. And the Saints 2-0. How does that game look to you?
I am afraid that that one can get away from them very, 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 very quickly, because you couldn't generate a pass rush on a mid-30s quarterback with a surgically repaired Achilles. You're going up against a Derek Carr who's just nailing Chris Olave right now. Alvin Kamara looks like vintage Alvin Kamara. Their line has been outstanding. And they got a lot of talent that nobody really recognizes on defense. And Marshawn Lattimore isn't even really playing for the Saints right now. He's hurt. So this could really get away easily from the Birds, unfortunately, going down to the Superdome. And all it takes is an early mistake from, you know, the Jalen Hurts throwing the interception or Nick Sirianni making – I still think that decision to go for it on fourth down early in the game, the second possession, instead of taking the 3 points, was about as boneheaded as it got.
Especially with a four-yard fourth and four.
Yeah. I understand the analytics. I understand being aggressive, but I think that was just being aggressive for aggressive's sake. Karma's undefeated, and you got had right there. Anyway, I just think down there, it could really, 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 really get away from them quite easily. One of the reasons why they were where they were was they were just really unable to – they could contain the Falcons and keep them out of the end zone, but they couldn't stop them in between the 20s. They're going to need to get some stops. The Saints have been getting a lot of big plays. We've seen the Eagles give up big plays and chunk yards. Everything that the Saints have done, everything that the Saints are right now – are things that the Eagles struggle to do on defense, and everything that they do well on defense indicates that it's going to be a struggle for the Eagles offense. And I just have a hard time seeing my way past a Saints win on this one.
Roger, I think you're right, because they're going to go down there with almost we got to, even though it's only the third game of the season, you know, we got to go down there and we got to win. We got to put on a much better performance than we put on this last weekend when we blew a game that we never should have blown.
Well, absolutely, and there is no way. But I just think that the Saints are getting confident, and he's looking really good at QB, and it's we talked about you. I think
he was there.
Yeah, Trevor said it, that the coach, Allen, is feeling a lot more comfortable, too. So that's
– let's hold it right there, fellas. I didn't know Doug was on the line already, and Frank just broke in to tell me he's already on. Take care. Thanks
a
lot, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
So let's go down there to Baltimore again, because On the line right now, who can't be too happy. I don't know what the Orioles are going to do tonight, but they have really, really. Let's start with the Orioles. The one thing we talked about earlier in the show, which I believe is maybe going to be a factor when they get into the playoffs. You really still have a number one and number two pitcher that are above, way above average. Mm-hmm. So if you have any kind of momentum going the last week of the season and you can rest these guys so that they're going to be 100% going into the playoffs, I think you can bounce back. But right now, and you know much better than I do, they are really struggling.
Well, I haven't asked Frank this question in a long time with regard to how many listeners typically tune into this, so I'll have to give you my answers in a G-rated form. If we were talking sitting next to each other with a couple beers, you would hear. I used some expletives last night as a noun, verb, and adjective in the same sentence because it's, to me, this is unwatchable. I mean, the product that they're putting out on the field right now is like 4A. It's not AAA and it's not Major League. It's somewhere in between. And I really don't see a clear path as an Oriole fan for them to be at all competitive, moving forward. I mean, I know since I've started watching hockey, like if you just get into the playoffs in hockey and you have a hot goaltender, like things can change. But I don't see how, like, because this has been, and for all the people, and you mentioned this, Don, because I watch this garbage every night, and for all the people that are, like, looking at the Orioles and they're saying, okay, well, if they get these people back and maybe something changed, well, nothing's changed since the All-Star break. We've been doing this for 3 months. So the Orioles are six games below 500 since the All-Star break. I mean, I don't see, who are they going to beat? Like right now they would be playing against Kansas City. Kansas City's going to go Reagans, Lugo, Waka, Singer. Okay, we're done. Like, we're going to play – we can't match up with that. I mean, Bobby Witt's going to hit 9 home runs in that series. Like, there's no way that we're going to win anything at this current point in time. Now, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't sit here and tell you. Like, and here's the thing. I told this to my wife tonight when we were just sitting here waiting for Braden to get himself together and go to bed. They have – a 5.5 game lead on the Detroit Tigers, who are looking to win that third wild card spot, which is currently held by the Twins right now. Mm-hmm. So they play the Tigers in a 3-game series. So I'm not even going to sit here from my front porch and tell you that the Orioles are guaranteed a playoff spot at this point. There's a chance in my mind that they miss the playoffs.
Oh boy, that would really be a collapse, Roger.
Well, Doug, when you talk about 4A, not 3A, I mean, what has happened? Is it injuries? Is it a combination?
Yes.
Is it poor management, more managing?
Well, that's an interesting topic that, again, I think we could spend the better part of an entire show discussing, because I think if you look at the front office of the Orioles and the quote-unquote, genius-level minds that they have with regard to putting baseball teams together like it's some, fantasy baseball team. Like, they're good at drafting players. They're obviously good at developing players. They're good, in stacking their farm systems. But once they get a hold of these players and they get to the major league level, like, it's like they don't know what to do with them. You know, like, we have all these prospects. Like, what do we do? And, like, they kick the can on – Ryan McKenna and Taron Vavra and all these middling players, to answer your question. They have Emmanuel Rivera was a cast-off that they picked up hitting 220-something. He's played relatively well as an Oriole. Levon Soto and Austin Slater, they got in trades with the Reds. They gave them 2 dozen Krispy Kremes for. they have a lot of these players, and they're getting forced into playing regular roles, and they're not designed to do that. And so the real reason what we're talking about here is Ramon Urias is out. They forced Jackson Holliday, a 20-year-old, into playing on a regular basis. Adley Rutschman has been absolutely abhorrent since. And so James McCann has catch. I mean, Ryan O'Hearn is playing on a regular basis. They don't have Ryan Mountcastle because he's hurt. They have all these injuries that have given all these other players a chance to play that can't play at this level. And we saw – we've been talking about this for months. We saw a really, really good version of Craig Kimball right before the All-Star break. And there were a lot of people that said he should be in the All-Star game. He had 23 saves, I think. He can't get 3 outs. And he threw his last pitch for the Orioles last night, and they finally designated him for assignment to get rid of him. He gave up 6 earned runs. He gave up 6 earned runs in 2/3 of an inning. Like,
Well, it's going to be difficult, but the one thing I will say on behalf of the Orioles is they do have a 1-2 punch 60 feet, 6 inches from home plate.
Yeah.
And anytime you have two pitchers and you're in a short series like this, you got a chance. I mean, as badly as they played, as you said, since the All-Star game, and as many people as they filtered in and out of the lineup, You still have a shot if you got two pitchers.
You do, but unfortunately, Dean Kramer has pitched wonderfully. He didn't pitch great tonight, but wonderfully in his last several starts.
Where are they tonight? I didn't see a score tonight.
I think it was 5-3 Giants. I think they're probably in the top of the eighth. But
okay,
if you're a starting pitcher for the Orioles right now, you have to think, I got to go out there and throw 7 innings of shutout or one run ball to have an absolute chance to score a run. The Orioles I don't know what just happened because I'm sitting on the front porch here, but they had bases loaded, 2 outs. They're down 5-3. I'm assuming that they didn't get anything moving there, but they can't get a hit with runners in scoring position. No one can seemingly come through when they need that big hit. And, it's just a really, when they lost 10-0 last night, I'm telling you, flipping the subject here, because I heard Mike talking about it. How do the Ravens lose at home against the Las Vegas Raiders when they're up 10 twice in the second half? That doesn't generally happen. So, right now as a Baltimore fan, and I'm listening to a lot of the 105.7 fan. They're talking. There are people out there that are just irate about Baltimore sports right now and how bad they are. So it's just not a good time to be a fan. you were talking about the Dallas game. It's very conceivable that the Orioles that the Ravens start 0-3 if they go down to Dallas and put their tail between their legs
When was the last time Harbaugh ever lost 3 games at the beginning of the season? Even 2 games is a miracle.
Yeah. Well, their offensive line cannot open a hole for anything. They can't pass protect. I think their defense, and you've got a rookie signal caller on the other side in Zach Orr. So they look pretty good in the first half, obviously the second half, and that's where their struggles have been even over the last couple of years. Todd Monken doesn't, I don't know that he can't get Mark Andrews and Isaiah Likely on the field together and be productive. The Ravens turn around and they hand the football off to Derrick Henry and he gets 3 yards and he gets 1 yard and now it's 3rd and 6. He comes off the field and there's no continuity to that offense right now. And it's a bad look too. Neither one of those teams have, they don't have the flow that they need right now. And it's okay. At least right now for the Ravens, they have the rest of their season to kind of make this right. And all they have to do is win. They could be, 9-8 and still win their, it's possible. Right. But as far as the Orioles are concerned, this is just, they are leaking oil and it's to get to this finish line, it's going to be tough.
Roger.
Okay. We'll go over the scores quickly. Giants over the Orioles 5-3.
Yep.
And that is at bottom of the eighth. The Twins and Guardians tied 2-2. That's bottom of the ninth. Braves are up 6-1 over the Reds, top of the ninth. Dodgers up over the Marlins, 6-3, top of the eighth. Red Sox up over the Rays, 2-1, end of the eighth. The Mets up over the Nationals, bottom of the sixth, 9-0. Tigers are up over the Royals, 4-1, in the bottom of the fourth. We talked about the Phillies game. Cardinals are ahead of the Pirates and also Blue Jays, Rangers, and then the rest to come. They're playing later tonight.
If the Orioles lose tonight and the Tigers win, they will have a 4.5 game lead over the Tigers for that last wild card spot. And keep in mind, they play the Tigers in a 3-game series.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, if you're a betting man, and I am, I'm not guaranteeing the fact that the Orioles make the playoffs. And I want everybody to understand how much of a collapse that would be for that to happen.
What is their record since the All-Star game?
They're 6 games under 500.
Wow. 15. Yeah. Unbelievable.
They have been absolutely one of the worst teams in baseball, even right before the All-Star break. They're 3-9 in their last 12 games. This is terrible. I can't even – when I come home from work, I'm on my way home and I'm listening to 98 Rock here, which is the Baltimore-based station that carries the Orioles, and I'm listening, and I'm like, I can't even listen to this on the radio. It's – you know, it's embarrassing. Like you guys have been there and done that because you've been lifelong fans of the Phillies or whatever. So you've experienced good years, bad years, and years in between. But God dang, coming off a 101 win season, and then going out getting Corbin Burns and with all the, you know, the rookies and things that they were touting, and we were healthy coming in, and Grayson Rodriguez and all these different things. My God, I understand regression and what that means, but 101 to go back to 84? Jesus. I mean, that's...
Yeah, they were looking just the opposite, to be honest with you, Doug. They were looking to go somewhere between 98 and 102. You know,
100%.
Not necessarily that they would beat the Yankees out, but that they would be right there between the two teams, and they were until a month ago, and then it just kept going down and down and down. Roger?
Well, but even at that trade deadline, though, like, we can all sit here and, I mean, like getting Dominguez, I thought, was a decent move, but getting Eflin was...
Well, this went awesome. Too fast tonight. Doug, we'll get you next week, and thank you very much.
Have a great week, Doug.
I hope the Ravens and the Orioles win a few games for you. All right, thank you. Our Commander-in-Chief, Frank Carl, take it over.
Thank you, Don. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in great appreciation. The men and women of the United States Armed Forces and the men with police and fire services, when you're out there and see somebody in a uniform, please let them know they're there. These programs are dedicated to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazwit, Sergeant Thomas Bainger, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Chris LeBeek, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Joe Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Anafo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Artith Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Chief Al Hogle, Longwood Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Highway Patrol Joe Bullock, Patrolman Highway Patrol Zachary Ben, Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Ramon Mendez, Philadelphia Police Department, and Fire Chief Corey Pumpty, Compacchiere, Buffalo Creek Fire Department. My brothers and sisters, you may be 10-7 at this point in time, and sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Till that time, and the roads rise up to meet you, and the winds be always at your back, and the rains fall softly on your fields, the sunshine light on your face. And until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the palm of his hands. Good night, God bless, and have a great week. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999's responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Good night, Bob. We love you and we miss you.